it was as if they didn't exist. And so I found that very painful as I read that. And that was seen in story after story for decade after decade, just this invisibility, as Mike's apology said, that we did not change, did nothing or little to change the narrative, the perception about who Black Americans, Black Kansas Cityans were.
Well, we will link to your whole series at democracynow.org. Murray Rose Williams, education writer at the Kansas City Star. Mike Fannin, president and editor of the Kansas City Star, which recently published an apology for the paper's racist history titled The Truth in Black and White, an apology from the Kansas City Star. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carlo Wills and Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras, our general manager, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Dennis Moynihan.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Kukatonin 2020, a commemorative Kwanzaa Kentu Fest on Thursday, December 31st from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., streaming online. Kukatonin celebrates African and African-American customs and traditions like cultural libations, wellness workouts, music, storytelling, comedic art expression, dance and movement of the African diaspora, and more, including a live concert performance presented by Esperanza Spalding. Again, that's Kukatonin 2020 Commemorative Kwanzaa Kentu Fest on Thursday, December 31st from 9:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. streaming online. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to listener-supported KBOO Portland. Love volunteer-powered, community-funded radio? Then join the thousands of individual supporters who make KBOO happen. We only have until December 31st to meet our end-of-the-year fundraising goal, so donate today. kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 21 prisoners in Oregon have now died from COVID-19. A more contagious strain of COVID-19 found in the United Kingdom and South Africa has reached the United States. And in international news, Argentina has become the third nation in South America to legalize abortion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 30th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. The Oregon Health Authority reported 713 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 111,227. Oregon health officials also reported 16 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,449. According to the Oregon Health Authority, more than 20,000 Oregonians have already received the COVID-19 vaccine. The state has more than 100,000 doses of the vaccine ready to go and plans to start ramping up vaccinations this week. As of now, the state is still in the initial phase of vaccinations, so only healthcare workers and employees, as well as residents of long-term care facilities, will be able to get the vaccine. Even as vaccines are distributed nationwide, case numbers and deaths remain near record levels. Nationally, nearly 20 million people in the United States have been infected with coronavirus. At least 340,000 people have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has infected more than 80 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.7 million people have died across the world. An incarcerated person at the Oregon State Penitentiary died from COVID-19 on Sunday. He is the 21st prisoner in Oregon to die while incarcerated. Oregon has over 14,000 prisoners statewide, and some of the largest outbreaks across the state have been in prisons. Prisoner advocates have been calling for early release or probation resentencing since the start of the pandemic. The Department of Corrections has started vaccinating staff, but its 400 vaccine allotment will fall short of truly protecting those imprisoned. Prisoners brought a lawsuit against Oregon state officials over their response to the COVID-19 pandemic. A judge declared the suit lawful last week. The ruling could have a national impact as prisons around the country are experiencing similar devastating consequences based on their own state's pandemic response. Juan Chavez is one of the civil rights attorneys representing the prisoners in this case. Chavez said, quote, "No one was sentenced to die of COVID-19 in prison. No one deserves that agonizing fate." There are over 2 million incarcerated people in the United States, with over half of those in state-funded institutions. Health authorities in Colorado identified the first United States case of a new, more contagious strain of COVID-19 Tuesday. The confirmed patient is a Colorado National Guardsman deployed to a local nursing home as part of the state's emergency response to a virus outbreak. A second Guard member is suspected but not yet confirmed of having the new variant. The strain has also reportedly been found in the nation's most populous state of California. The strain is thought to originate in the United Kingdom, where it mutated from the original virus that has infected over 82 million people worldwide to date. While the UK variant is said to spread more quickly, officials say there is no evidence it causes more severe symptoms or complications. It was first identified in Britain earlier this year and quickly became the dominant strain in the region, prompting travel restrictions and disrupting international trade. The Associated Press reports that the infected Colorado Guardsman had not been traveling prior to his diagnosis, indicating the strain was present in the U.S. before he contracted it. He is currently isolating at home with mild symptoms. So far, authorities express confidence that the new mutations will not affect the ability of current vaccines to build immunity to the virus, but warn the same may not be true for future mutations. As viruses reproduce in the body, mistakes in the reproduction process can cause new genetic combinations that affect the virus's shape and properties. If the mutations prove more effective at reproducing the virus, they become dominant over older, less effective strains. Vaccines are designed to combat specific viral proteins, and if those targeted proteins change due to a mutation, new vaccines may be required. This doesn't mean potential new strains will become invincible, but it does mean future COVID-19 vaccines may resemble current flu vaccines and change with the season. Contact tracers in Colorado are currently working to map the path of the new variant in the United States. The UK strain has been identified in multiple countries worldwide, including Canada. Advocates for survivors of trauma are urging folks to take care of themselves this holiday season. Here's Lily Bolke with more on the story.
People who advocate for survivors of traumatic events are urging folks to take care of themselves during this holiday season. In Las Vegas, New Year's fireworks may bring up reminders for survivors of the October 1st shooting in 2017, where more than 50 people were killed and more than 500 injured. Tanil Pereira with the Vegas Strong Resiliency Center says this time of year is stressful in its own right, so it's especially important to find coping skills to help people be mindful and aware of how they're feeling.
Checking in with yourself and having people around you that are kind of aware of where you're coming from and what things impact you.
She recommends staying connected to support systems, even though it may be harder to interact during the pandemic. But she notes for some people, the social distancing alleviates the stress of explaining to others why they might not want to go out over holidays. Simple self-care measures are recommended: staying hydrated, taking walks, writing in a journal, and making it a point to do something helpful for others can also be a positive personal step. Pereira points out that everyone experiences the holidays differently, and people dealing with trauma need to be especially kind to themselves.
It's natural to sometimes feel sad or angry when you're seeing others enjoying themselves and not dealing with this type of situation. That's okay, you know, to allow yourself those feelings.
The Vegas Strong Resiliency Center has online support groups, from group therapy sessions to trauma-informed mindfulness meditation. Pereira urges anyone dealing with trauma to seek help from their local community service center if they need it. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has introduced new legislation that will tie COVID relief to a commission to look for voter fraud. This bill was introduced just after McConnell blocked progressive efforts to force a vote on a bill that would require $2,000 payments to most Americans. McConnell's legislation ties relief payments to money that will repeal legal protections for internet companies and will establish a commission to study virtually non-existent voter fraud. The $600 payments that did pass both houses of Congress are considered to be little help in the face of coronavirus economic fallout. The fact that McConnell wants to condition greater relief on injuring internet companies, as well as pushing a false narrative of voter fraud, is not the only problem with the proposed legislation. Conservative policy analyst Rachel Bovard tweeted that the problem with McConnell's legislation is that it, quote, violates the constitutional requirement that revenue bills initiate in the House, and so it is illegitimate from the start since McConnell is part of the Senate. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, quote, any move like this by Senator McConnell would be a blatant attempt to deprive Americans of a $2,000 survival check. New polling shows that the proposed $2,000 payments are overwhelmingly popular among U.S. voters, including Republicans. President-elect Biden says vaccine rollout is not progressing as it should. With more on that story and others, it's Laura Rosbrow-Tallum with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The motion to reconsider be considered made and laid upon the table with no intervening action or debate.
Is there objection to the modification?
Object.
Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell blocked Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer's move yesterday to immediately approve President Trump's request to increase individual stimulus checks to $2,000. The Treasury Department has begun issuing the $600 payments. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders also tried to force a vote on the increase before the Senate considers overriding Trump's veto of the military spending bill. That vote could come any day. Meanwhile, McConnell says the Senate would begin a process to consider bigger payments, but only paired with two other demands from President Donald Trump: protecting alleged election security and removing some legal protections for technology companies, both personal issues for the president. Democrats are unlikely to support either measure, but the maneuver could give Republicans the ability to say they supported the increase, and Democrats blocked it. Some Republicans say they support the increase, including both Georgia's Republican senators facing a tense runoff election next Tuesday. Senator David Perdue expressed this new position on Fox News yesterday.
I'm delighted to support the president in this $2,000. It's really a $1,400 increment over what we've already done. And I think with the vaccine coming, I think this is absolutely appropriate. So I fully support what the president is doing right now.
Georgia Democratic Senate candidate, the Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, encouraged voters to usher in new leadership earlier this week.
As we consider a Congress that has taken 8 and 9 months to do anything to provide just a little bit of COVID relief, and it's not nearly enough, it still seems to be the case that our leaders have a heart problem. You will perform moral surgery on a nation in need of heart.
A federal judge also blocked two Georgia counties Monday from purging around 4,000 voters from the rolls before the January 5th runoff that determines political control of the Senate. So far, early voting has broken all Georgia's records for runoff elections. President-elect Joe Biden protested the speed of the vaccine rollout at a virtual press conference yesterday.
The effort to distribute and administer the vaccine is not progressing as it should. If it continues to move as it is now, it's going to take years, not months, to vaccinate the American people.
Biden wants 100 million shots of the vaccine delivered within his first 100 days in office, and that means more funding.
It would take ramping up 5 to 6 times the current pace to 1 million shots a day.
Jeffrey Levy, professor of health policy and management at George Washington University, gives the Trump administration some credit for Operation Warp Speed.
They really pushed hard and pushed the envelope on creating a vaccine as quickly as possible. They did not make a parallel investment in building a distribution system that would assure that those vaccines could get into people's arms.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Argentina became the third South American country and the largest in Latin America to legalize abortion after a Senate vote on Wednesday. The vote approved a bill that changes existing health laws to allow elective abortions in the first 14 weeks of pregnancy. It was sponsored by Argentina's left-leaning president, Alberto Fernandez, and passed Argentina's lower legislative house earlier this month. Fernandez took to Twitter to celebrate, saying, quote, "Safe, legal, and free abortion is now law. Today we are a better society that expands rights to women and guarantees public health." In most countries of the region, abortions are limited to extreme situations such as rape or a threat to the mother's life. Some nations don't even allow abortions in these extreme instances. They ban the practice entirely. Supporters of the bill argued that over 3,000 Argentinian women have died from underground abortions in the last 37 years. A previous attempt to pass pro-choice legislation failed 2 years ago. This bill's victory is attributed to 5 years of mass protest, spearheaded by a grassroots women's movement, as well as a new left-wing president who ran on a platform for abortion rights. Giselle Carino is the head of the region's International Planned Parenthood Federation. Carino told reporters all credit must go to the pro-choice activists who have held rallies, Twitter campaigns, and strikes over the years, all while sporting the green scarf, which has become an international symbol for women's rights. Carino praised the nation's women who, quote, "never stopped occupying the streets and the social networks, not even against the backdrop of the pandemic, and kept up their struggle. If anything made the difference, it was this." Activists in Brazil, Colombia, and Chile are currently working on similar legalization efforts. They hope the victory in Argentina is the first of many on the continent. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on addiction care during the holiday season. At 6, it's special public affairs programming. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will include heavy rain and a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be scattered showers with a high of 50. Today in history, in 2017, activist Erica Garner died. Garner was the daughter of Eric Garner, who was killed by police in 2014. She remained a critic of the NYPD until her death. The quote of the day is from Malcolm X, who said, quote, "If someone puts their hands on you, make sure they never put their hands on anybody else again." Department of Interior Secretary nominee Deb Haaland tells tribal leaders she's committed to fully honoring the federal government's trust and treaty obligations. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. Officials are calling for an investigation into the tasing of a Native American man at the Petroglyph National Monument in Albuquerque. Daryl House told KOB-TV that he went off the trail to avoid a large group and maintain social distancing. He says a ranger followed him and told him to return to the trail and then asked him for identification. House, a former Marine, refused. He filmed the initial encounter and posted it on Instagram, which includes his small dog, Geronimo, barking.
I don't want to ID myself. So, I'm on a trail now.
That would be refusing a lawful order. You understand that? And then you'll be detained until I can ID you. Do you understand that?
You're not going to touch me, sir.
A second video taken by House's sister shows the ranger tasing House several times after he fell on the ground convulsing and cried for help. House told the TV station he has often left the trail at the monument to pray and meditate, but has never been challenged for doing so. Executive Director of Utah Dene Bekea, Woody Lee, said the incident was a violation of religious, cultural, and human rights, and noted in a press release that the Petroglyph National Monument is a sacred site with a history of indigenous peoples fighting for religious freedom. Democratic lawmakers from New Mexico, U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich and U.S. Representative Ben Ray Lujan demanded an immediate investigation. The two wrote in a joint press release, quote, "This landscape is sacred to tribes and holds deep meaning for the people of New Mexico. Everyone should feel safe and welcome on our public lands." The National Park Service has released the body camera footage from the ranger and said the incident is under review and has been referred to its Internal Affairs Office for investigation. In a statement, NPS said before the officer used his taser, he tried to resolve the situation with a warning and by providing information on why going off trail could hurt the site. NPS said both House and his sister provided fake names and dates of birth to the officer. House was cited for being in a closed area off trail, providing false information, and failing to comply with a lawful order. His sister received citations for providing false information and being in a closed area off trail. In a virtual meeting with tribal leaders this week, U.S. Representative Deb Haaland said she's committed to fully honoring the federal government's trust and treaty obligations. The Hill reports Haaland said she will work to address the disproportionate harm Native Americans face from what she says are long-running environmental injustices and climate change. Haaland is President-elect Joe Biden's nominee to head the U.S. Department of Interior. She's a member of Laguna Pueblo and also has Jemez Pueblo heritage. If confirmed, she would be the first Native American cabinet secretary. Leaders of a California city are considering renaming a park after a state-recognized tribe. The park is currently named after President Andrew Jackson, who oversaw the forced relocation of tribes in the southeastern United States to Oklahoma, an action now referred to as the Trail of Tears. The East Bay Times reports the Alameda Parks and Recreation Commission unanimously recommends renaming it to Chochenyo Park after a lineage of the Olon tribe. The name was among more than 150 names submitted through surveys and public meetings. The name change requires a vote by the city council, which is not obligated to take the commission's recommendation. And this week, Google celebrated Alaska Native civil rights champion Elizabeth Paradovich on its Doodle. She played a key role in the passage of the first anti-discrimination law in the United States. On December 30, 1941, she and her husband, both Clinkett, saw a sign on the door of an inn that read, "No Natives Allowed." It was just the latest example of blatant discrimination she and her husband, Roy, found when they moved to Juneau and were unable to buy a house. The couple helped to draft Alaska's first anti-discrimination bill, which finally passed in 1945. In 1988, the Alaska State Legislature declared February 16th as Elizabeth Paradovich Day. Earlier this year, the U.S. Mint released a $1 gold coin with her likeness. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael looks back on 2020.
Two more days to the year. How will you remember 2020? Months of Black Lives Matter protests, the first surge of COVID, store shelves bare of toilet paper, pasta, bleach, more and more masks, the wildfires bringing post-apocalyptic skies and a second layer of isolation. Jobs lost, restaurants and other businesses lost, people lost but not dead. We wade through, we see how strong we are, patience tested, relationships tested, not always passing grades, but lots of learning opportunities, times it's hard to tell silver lining from gray clouds. A new president, but probably the same old roadblock Senate. Three new city councilors with big business increasing its influence. Vaccines starting to get around slowly. There's more to change than putting up a new calendar. With change, the dates are trivial compared to the what and how of change fueled by all of us. Our numbers make everything happen. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley has announced that next week he will introduce a measure in the Senate to challenge the result of the Electoral College vote. This will force the House and Senate to debate the results of at least one state and vote on whether to accept Joe Biden's victory. Democrats have a strong majority in the House, and a number of Republican senators have acknowledged Biden's victory. So Hawley's action does nothing but stall Biden's certification. Hawley said he was taking the action because, quote, at the very least, Congress should investigate allegations of voter fraud and adopt measures to secure the integrity of our elections. In the 2000 elections, after the Supreme Court stopped Florida from continuing to count votes, several Democratic members of the House went to the Senate, pleading for one Democratic senator to do what Hawley is planning to do, but not one did. An attack on the airport in the Yemeni port city of Aden left at least 26 people dead and more than 60 injured. The attack apparently targeted a plane carrying members of the country's newly formed government. Several civilians, journalists, and government officials are believed to be among the dead. No one has claimed responsibility for the bombings yet, and it isn't known if mortars, missiles, or drones were used. Another explosion hit close to the city's heavily fortified Mashiq Palace, where cabinet members were taken following the incident at the airport. Yemen's new unity government was sworn in last week in Saudi Arabia. It was designed to mend the violent rift between the internationally recognized government and the separatist government, which currently controls the city of Aden. Damages to the airport could leave the blockaded country of 28 million people with only one fully functioning airport. Researchers at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies want to develop plants that could bury carbon pollution deep underground. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Plants absorb carbon dioxide as they grow and store it in their roots, stems, and leaves. But when plants decompose, much of that carbon returns to the atmosphere. Joanne Corey is a plant biologist and geneticist at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. Her team is working to develop new plant varieties that can lock more carbon in the soil long term. She says these new plants need to have more and deeper roots in order to bury the carbon down deep, where there are fewer microorganisms that can decompose the plant
and make all the carbon dioxide go back up in the atmosphere.
Corey says the ideal plants will also have high concentrations of a molecule called suberin, which is found in cork. It holds a lot of carbon and breaks down very slowly. The project is in its early stages.
What we're doing right now is trying to understand what those traits really mean in terms of genes.
With that information, researchers can selectively breed for those traits or engineer them into widely grown plants, such as corn and wheat.
We want to put these all into crop plants because you really need a lot of land if you're going to do this.
Corey hopes that in 10 years, these climate-friendly crops will be growing in farm fields around the globe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
An important anti-corruption measure depends on the Senate's override of the vetoed defense bill. Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service has more on the story.
The most sweeping anti-money laundering reform in decades could die this week, depending on whether the U.S. Senate is able to override President Donald Trump's veto of the defense spending bill. The Corporate Transparency Act, part of the larger National Defense Authorization Act, would require shell companies to declare the name of any person with a significant ownership stake. Clark Gascoigne with the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition says criminals use anonymous shell companies to launder hundreds of billions of dollars a year through the U.S. economy.
A host of bad actors utilize these anonymous shell companies to carry out their crimes and launder the proceeds with impunity, and for the first time ever, we're going to be putting an end to that.
He says American shell companies are routinely used by rogue nations to undermine national security and evade sanctions. They're also used by corrupt individuals to evade taxes or pay bribes, and by human traffickers or drug cartels to conceal their crimes. Gascoigne says that the UK and the European Union already require this kind of corporate transparency, so the United States is playing catch-up.
We're the easiest place right now, according to a number of academic studies, to set up an anonymous company to launder your wealth. Now that we're moving forward, we're going to be able to push other countries to clean up their act.
California Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who chairs the House Financial Services Committee, has championed this legislation and pushed to have it included in the defense bill. President Trump vetoed the defense bill because it also includes stripping the names of Confederate generals from some U.S. military bases. And he wants Congress to add a provision to make social media companies liable for comments posted by their users. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 30th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law and Dan Raphael. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Megan Kamrick, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Suzanne Potter, and Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nat Moon. Stay safe, wear a mask. Coming up next, it's an encore broadcast about addiction care over the holidays with KBOO's Annette Newell.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For people in addiction recovery, the holidays can be an especially challenging time. And this year with the COVID pandemic, isolation, unemployment, and ill health for a lot of people, certainly these are all weighing down very hard. Daniel Gillette is the Columbia Region Provider Leader for Ideal Option. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, tell us a little bit about what Ideal Option is and some of the services you offer.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ideal Option, we have about 75 outpatient addiction medicine clinics throughout 10 states in the United States. And we offer low-barrier medication-assisted treatment for a number of substance use disorders, primarily opiate use disorder, stimulant use disorder, alcohol use disorder, and also tobacco use disorder.
And here in the Pacific Northwest, where are you located?
So we're spread throughout the Pacific Northwest. We have a number of clinics in Washington. We have 5 clinics in Oregon as well. And then we're also in the Montana and Idaho region. But Washington is where our clinic was founded, and that's where we have the majority of our clinics.
How about in Portland? Do you have clinics in Portland?
We have a clinic located in Hillsboro, Oregon, and we also have 2 clinics just over the state line in Vancouver, Washington.
Okay, so a number of your patients are in the Portland area, Portland metro area.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the special dangers of relapse during the holidays?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and one we're seeing a lot in our clinical work. And I think it deserves a little bit of background to really understand why the holidays present such a challenge to those in recovery. Addiction is a very complex disease process, and I think a little background provides good context. So, substance use disorder is a chronic medical disease, which results from a really complex interplay of behavior, environmental, and biology. Unfortunately, the manifestations of substance use disorder are much more devastating than other chronic diseases like high blood pressure or diabetes, and it's typically characterized by compulsory substance use despite behavior that's self-destructive and can really negatively impact relationships with friends and family. So another piece when we're looking at the holidays in relation to recovery, it's really important to understand that chronic substance use results in measurable changes in multiple areas of the brain, including those areas involved in reward processing, impulse control, stress response. And those changes are what make affected individuals particularly sensitive to acute stressors in their environment, which can result in cravings and can precipitate a return to use. So the reason I give that background, the holidays can be stressful for anyone. They represent a particularly challenging time for individuals with a history of substance use disorder to maintain stable recovery because of that the changes that occur in their stress response. We have the data that supports from the CDC that supports that alcohol and drug-related deaths spike in December and January. So whether it's emotional stress from family conflict, financial strain, loneliness, grief, these tend to be magnified by the holidays and can contribute to increased cravings that may result in relapse because of those changes in the brain chemistry we see in folks with a history of opiate use disorder or any substance use disorder for that matter.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the signs for family members to watch out for then?
I think looking at primarily changes in emotion and behavior, I think those are the primary indicators that someone in recovery may be struggling and may be at risk for return to use. So looking for things like self-isolation, avoidance of the recovery support system. You also want to be on the lookout for negative emotional changes. That can include things like depressed mood, increased anxiety, anger. I would also look for any sudden behavioral changes, major deviations from routine, whether that individual starts missing work, erratic sleeping, or eating habits as well. And one last thing to look for is an individual starting to romanticize prior drug use and express discontent or discomfort with their current recovery. Those are all indicators that a patient may be at higher risk for return to use.
Yeah, it's going to be harder to keep track of that kind of stuff now, though, because we are all in isolation, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point. The COVID pandemic has added another layer of difficulty for individuals with substance use disorder, particularly those in early recovery who may require more treatment resources and may rely more heavily on their support system. And COVID has limited access to really critical recovery resources like residential treatment. And it's also disrupted important recovery activities like 12-step meetings and intensive outpatient program classes, both of which are really important to allow folks with substance use disorder to feel connected to their recovery support.
So normally, do you see like a spike in people wanting to get some help during the holidays at your clinics?
I think so. And again, each individual's recovery journey is different, but I do think there's a sense that the holidays can, in some cases, represent an opportunity for change in heading into the new year by making efforts to stabilize in the recovery. But on the same token, we also see a lot of individuals who have been very stable in recovery start to struggle with things like increased cravings, using dreams, and these are a result of some of those stressors and the stress response we talked about. But yeah, certainly make no mistake, the holidays are an extraordinarily challenging time for those in recovery mm-hmm. on the whole.
What advice would you give to people who are having these struggles right now?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to go back to the basics of successful recovery during the holidays. It really comes down to maintaining a structured, supportive recovery environment. So the best advice I could give would be to be aware of and avoid the people, places, and things that are associated with prior substance use. We know that these are very potent environmental cues and triggers for individuals with a history of substance use disorder and can certainly precipitate return to use. I think it's important to maintain structure and healthy routines, whether that's exercising regularly, eating well, sleeping well. Despite some of the challenges presented by COVID, I think it's really critical to continue reaching out to the support networks, whether that's participating in 12-step meetings, connecting with a sponsor, or just relying on folks in your life who are supportive of your recovery. I also recommend pursuing some sort of counseling support, whether that's mental health counseling, chemical dependency counseling, or in certain cases, grief counseling. If individuals don't have access to those types of support, I recommend journaling. It can help process anxiety and work through some of the complex emotions that arise during the holidays. And also planning ahead. You know, oftentimes holidays mean holiday parties, and sometimes that can expose folks in recovery to the people, places, and things that they have historically associated with using. So I think it's really important to have an escape plan. If at any point they begin to feel uncomfortable, whether it's from the stressful environment or stressful interactions with family, having that escape plan can be really important.
Okay, tell me, what do you mean by an escape plan?
Sure. So if you're in a situation where you're being exposed to environmental cues or triggers, these can cause increased cravings. And it's really important to make sure that individual gets out of that environment and is able to connect with someone in their support before that craving escalates to a point where it can precipitate a return to use.
I think a lot of people, not only are they isolated, but they're probably ashamed maybe in the situation of addiction, and yet it affects so many people. So what would your message be about that, about not being ashamed of trying to get some help?
Yeah. So I think addiction is still very misunderstood. And one of the main challenges which makes dealing with addiction so difficult is that a lot of the manifestations of the disease are antisocial behavior, lying, stealing. And I know that these are driven by the changes in the brain chemistry from addiction. But it can be very challenging as a family member or a friend of someone in addiction to be sympathetic or to be empathetic with that individual and what they're going through. So I think just reminding ourselves that this is a very complex brain disease. This is a chronic disease. It's not a reflection of someone's willpower or moral failing or personality. It's a brain chemistry disease. And I think having that understanding can help friends and family members and patients themselves reframe how they approach their addiction and hopefully lower some of the barriers to making sure that patient has really good support at home and also has access to treatment through clinics like ours.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add about this topic?
I just appreciate your willingness to shine some light on this really challenging disease and this particularly challenging time for folks who are struggling with substance use disorder. And my hope is that if we have more education and more opportunities to talk about addiction, we can help decrease some of the stigma and allow folks to feel more comfortable reaching out to those in the community and reaching out to support to help them get healthy.
And that was Daniel Gullett, the Columbia Region Provider Leader for Ideal Option. I am Annette Newell.
My name is J.D. Gear.
And where do you live, J.D.?
I live in Bend, Oregon.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about yourself and your life and what happened where you had an issue with addiction.
I've struggled with addiction since I was about 13 or 14 years old. I got into a car wreck, and after the car wreck, they prescribed me medication, and I took the medication and like kind of instantly fell in love with the instant satisfaction and the instant gratification I got from that, and the way it just kind of made everything else go away. And then I continued to struggle with addiction through my teenage years, ended up going to prison when I was about 21, got out, stayed clean for about 3 years, and then ended up kind of falling back into it. And then in 2018, I moved to Bend, Oregon, still kind of continued to struggle with addiction. I was been homeless in Bend, Oregon for about 2 years, and then about in September, I found out I had a heart infection and I had issues with my heart, so I was hospitalized for 8 weeks. And kind of when I was in the hospital, like on my deathbed, pretty much, I decided I didn't want to live that life, and I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die an addict, so I decided to get help, and have been clean since.
Where did you get help at?
I got help through Best Care here in Bend. A couple of the recovery mentors from Best Care came and see me while I was in the hospital, and they got me set up with Turning Points Recovery, and it's housing and treatment. And so now I'm currently in Turning Points, and I go to Ideal Options for my Suboxone treatment weekly, and so I do that, and I do Turning Points.
You described a treatment. What is the treatment you're talking about?
So the treatment I do is 5 days a week from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. I do different classes like CBT, which is cognitive behavior therapy. I do DBT, which is diversional behavior therapy. We do like mindfulness group where like we learn how to be mindful of ourselves and others. And we also do like relapse prevention groups, and we do MRT, which is a book where you go through and you have to do 16 steps that kind of mimic the steps of NA, but are slightly different, where we have to write out some of our stuff and some of our issues and then do like speeches in front of people about it to be able to pass to go on to the next step.
Tell me, you know, we're in the holiday season right now. Why is this such a tough time for those struggling with addiction and to defeat this addiction? Why does this time of year present extra challenges?
For the holiday seasons, a lot of us have to deal with the wreckage of our past and the things that our addiction has brought for us, which is we lose a lot of family members, we lose a lot of trust. Me, myself, I don't have family, and a lot of people don't. A lot of people stray away from their families in this disease, because some people just kind of shun people with addiction. Some people steal from their families, and so their families don't want them around. So for us, it's being alone on the holidays, being depressed, and just kind of feeling hopeless and that nobody cares because we don't really have anybody. So for me, it's really important to be in recovery and be around people this time of year, because you learn that through recovery, you do have people. There's people that care. People that you never met before care about you. And if you put forth the effort to try and change your life, you'll see how quickly those